Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2018. Now, I'm sorry, but there was a problem with the getting the Bronx blogger. There was some scheduling confusion, and so he wasn't able to make it on time because he didn't realize he was supposed to be coming on an hour ago. Just to do with these dreadful time zones, it's incredibly confusing for everyone. So I don't think he's going to make it this year. It's a shame, but there are only well, this night and then one other night left, so I don't think we can do it this year. It's a shame. I was looking forward to it. What can I do? It's too bad. Okay, so but that's that's one thing. But the better news is that I'm now here with Dave from the Distributors channel. Now I know that many people have been looking forward to. Many people requested that I have the Distributors on this year and last year. I can't remember what happened last year, but for one reason or another, we didn't do it last year. But we did arrange it for this year. So Dave, Distributist, welcome to Millennial.
Well, I'm actually really glad I got the chance to talk to you, Mose. I think this conversation's been a long time coming. A lot of things have happened over the last year, and everyone on the right is sort of trying to figure out how to deal with them. I know, I can't, if 2017 seems so far away. It's almost hard to believe that as much happened in this year of time has actually happened to me. This time in Millennial, Jean-Francois Gariepy wasn't really a thing. That whole thing with Sargon hadn't happened yet. It feels like ages ago.
No one had heard the word liberalist this time last year.
Yes. It's like some kind of strange fruit fly. It was born, reached maturity, bred, and died within the space of 12 months, and now it is
And
no more, I think.
as for internet blood sports, that all happened in 3 months, really.
Oh, well, yeah, it's odd. I mean, I think what I was going to come on here and talk about a little bit, and I kind of figured that this would sort of be the elephant in the room is sort of my perspectives on the right. For people who don't know me, I have a YouTube channel called The Distributist. I have a very I'm trying to work on a publication called Via Obscura, where we try to focus on cultural issues. And I guess some background is I started this channel really thinking that I'd be coming from a much different perspective than I actually was. When I started this channel, I started to criticize Sargon, and I really believed then that some slightly cooler version of sort of Federalist style, I don't want to say conservatism, but Federalist style William Buckley conservatism was the answer. And that really where the Catholic Church was after John Paul II had was the definitive form to follow through with an answer to globalization, with an answer to progressivism. And since then, I've had to just reevaluate a lot of things and adapt to changing circumstances. But and I think that there have been a lot of insights in that time. I don't know if I'm rambling here, but maybe I'll go on or
Go on.
okay. So, it seems to me, and this is sort of where I was headed with this, is the West as we know it is sort of its institutional ability to maintain itself is dissolving, and it's dissolving in the light of modernity and in particularly global techno-capitalism. This is essentially not acting like some kind of it's not acting like a multicultural force. It's acting like an anti-cultural force. It's essentially acting to melt down and destroy all forms of humanity that have any relevance outside of direct consumption. This means that this force has become allied with the most pathological elements of what we used to call progressivism, and is in the process of using that as a motivation to devour everything that is human and that can resist and can resist this progressive force. I know that. And I'm going to mention this in passing. I know that I've interacted with a lot of people on the alt-right, and I've been highly criticized for my anti-racialism or non-racialism. But that is largely because I see that the fight of the right and the cause of the right is not one particular race. It's not the white race, or I don't like the word whiteness. It's not the indigenous European race. It's not the Asian race. It's the human race. It's having a humanity that is at all autonomous from the ability of people inside bureaucracy, inside corporate and government offices to manipulate it and to change it and to benefit from it. And it's not, I don't see the right really as against multiculturalism as I see it as against anti-culturalism. The left is not multicultural. I don't want to give it that. At most, it's sort of a corporate multiculturalism that wants to dissolve all cultures down to, well, their consumable products. I know you're very famous for the wide range of restaurants, but that's actually more profound than you might know. Also, the incredible, that's more profound than you might know. That's not simply an excuse for immigration. That's the sum and total statement of what progressive global capital wants to reduce all cultures to. Yes. European, and it's, Asian, it's, and African.
It's the sum total of the progressive's interest in culture. They just want it all to be another, a consumable product, and an enjoyable experience, a meaningless distraction.
Do you remember Star Trek The Next Generation?
Of course. I watched of course, but that's misleading because I didn't watch it at the time. I watched it from in 2010. Yes, 2010. I watched the whole thing, the whole 7 series. I really liked it. It's much better than Voyager.
There's this classic episode where the Q character, who's sort of the walk-on anti-progressive, he's the foil for Captain Jean-Luc Picard, this omnipotent being who thinks mankind is flawed, whereas Picard thinks in some ways, like a progressive does, that mankind is perfectible. But there's this classic episode where Q introduces the Borg. He artificially contrives for the Enterprise to meet the Borg well ahead of when humanity was meant to meet the Borg.
And that's that's the first time he appears, isn't it? And it's the first time the Borg appear.
The first time the Borg appear.
It's at the end of the first season. Yes.
Q frames the entire series. But when Jean-Luc Picard, and the Borg, everyone knows them from, but they're like the big cube-like creatures that assimilate everything, right? And they rob every distinctiveness from their collective species, right? And Picard asks, before he's really encountered the Borg, he asks Q what the Borg are, and Q says, the Borg are the ultimate consumer. They only understand what they can consume. And that is essentially...
Hold on a minute. I think you might be... I don't want to mess this up, but I think you're misremembering. I think he says they're the ultimate user.
Oh, they're the ultimate user.
As in users of computers. That was the terminology in 1987, wasn't it? So they're talking about it as... But either way, it maps onto it. It means the same thing in our context. So that's fine. Go on.
Maybe shown up for my knowledge of Star Trek The Next Generation. But that's...
Oh my God, don't say that. That makes me seem dreadful. Come on. I just don't want to be a Trekkie. You know, it's like in the same way, I like Doctor Who, but I don't want to be a Doctor Who fan. You know, spare me that. But have a pedantic memory for it because that particular phase interested me at the time. I remember hearing it in 2010 and thinking, that's interesting. So it's stuck in my memory. But I might be wrong. Maybe it is consumer.
I think, at any rate, the message is that the Borg, that this force is sort of total deracination of both the individual and the groups that they assimilate. These creatures, they only understand the things they're assimilating from a very functional point of view, what you put in versus what you get out. And that is essentially, what the progressive globalists see when they see cultures. They do not see distinct things that need to be preserved. They see pieces that can be deassembled, scooped up, liquidated in order to fuel something else.
Yes. They don't see meaningfulness. They don't see these things as meaningful or, God forbid, sacred.
Exactly. So what they do is they just scoop these cities and the culture up right off the planet, right? And then they essentially devour it and retool it. And that is more or less what we're dealing with when we look at something like progressive globalism. It's not a force of multiculturalism. It will not create something like multiculturalism. The vision, well, I mean, it's sort of funny. The vision either, there, I mean, there's two visions of multiculturalism, both of which progressivism is not going to generate.
And the thing is, just before you proceed, there's also a necessary distinction between multiculturalism and multiracialism. And because the fact is, there are some progressives who I think would be absolutely fine with doing away with all of that cultural baggage, which is so complicated and often bigoted, and just having everyone as a Western consumer, but we're all different colors, right?
Yes.
Because after all, they don't really give a shit about the cultures anyway. I mean, very few SJWs actually know anything about the cultures that they purport to celebrate. So, you know, and the other part of it is, I think that the challenge is multiracial. It's not multicultural, because, you know, if you have French and German and a Danish culture and all this, and they're all in one farmer's market, nobody would give a shit. No liberal would celebrate that. No conservative would be threatened by that. No one cares. So it's really multiracial. And so there's a necessary distinction to be made. I think that multiculturalism is largely just a euphemism for multiracialism.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because I was going to just, there's several multicultural visions that are sort of, I mean, I come from a very, very progressive community. I spent most of my life in a very, very progressive community. And there are a variety of multicultural visions that are floating around. One is the multicultural vision that's oftentimes talked about in universities, where you imagine sort of like a collection of tribes, like a bunch of people living in a city. They all have their cultures and they're all carrying forward their cultural traditions into the future, but they're all in close proximity to each other and they're all somehow cooperating. The other one is, I call it sort of like the Cheerios version of multiculturalism, which is a bunch of cultures essentially assimilate into what amounts to 1950s white American culture. This is certainly the vision of multiculturalism sold to most conservatives. Unfortunately, neither of these visions is going to be procured by progressivism, because progressivism does not want to have any cultural apparatus that could sustain human order in that way. Either of the kind where a bunch of races are assimilated into one dominant cultural framework or religious framework, which can occur in certain circumstances, although we could argue about how likely that is to occur, or the one where people actually maintain their cultures going forward. What happens is that people are put into these communities, they're thrown into these societies with the hope that the destruction of their cultures will remove barriers to these people becoming addicted to consumption. In the lowercase examples, becoming addicted to drugs, becoming addicted to certain forms of highly stimulating media. And that essentially, I think that this project of deassembling cultures is serving a larger goal of just a dehumanization of humanity, and not just specifically targeted at one group. Although I think very notably, as you point out, you could argue that some groups are seen as a higher priority to sort of dissemble.
Oh, yes. I mean, I do think there's a definite targeted attack on the white race, and multiculturalism is part of that. The doctrine of multicultural policy, whatever, is being used towards that end. It's also true that other races get caught up in this, as I think, as collateral in the West, Blacks, Hispanics, Muslims, and so on. And I know that Muslims aren't a race, but let's not piss around.
They are also cultural civilizations, so.
Yes. Other groups get caught up in that, but the target is white people. It's also true that in outside of the West, let's say East Asians also get affected by modernity and nihilism. And they have very low birth rates and so on. And so you could say, and I know that there are globalist powers trying to encroach on that part of the world as well. So, and it's possible that after Europe and the West is destroyed, they will move on to that part of the world, and China and so on. But yeah, it does seem that for now, at least, the focus is on destroying the white race. I mean, I think it's that stark. There's a reason why the race mixing adverts, it's always a white woman and a black guy. It's never a white family. You'll get a black family, but not a white family. We could go into a huge litany of examples and evidence of this, but I don't think that needs to be done.
It is apparent that indigenous, I don't like the term white, it is apparent that indigenous European peoples seem to be first on the docket for liquidation, but that is simply because they haven't gotten around to the other ones yet, right? That's just in the future.
Oh, come on. I can't see that. I have to disagree there.
Really?
All of this stuff about whiteness, white privilege.
Well, there's a reason for that.
What other terms? I mean, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's undoubtable that they're focusing on, like, that progressive globalism is particularly offended by again, what the groups that are considered white, right? They're called white, right? It is very apparent that they're focused on that, right? But to me, like, this is part of a process. I think my theory of this is this. So the people who are driving this anti-cultural force in the world, the most important thing is that they're white. They're people who come from, well, either European or European diaspora communities. And it is very, very important that their power not decline faster than the power of the West itself. So their power largely stems from the fact that they're in charge of what, I mean, we could call it the Western countries or the global power source that derives from Western governments. And they're very, very concerned about the decline of these countries' power, decline of their economic output. They're concerned that their power will wane. So as these countries' power diminishes and decreases, they're going to try ever harder to totally obliterate any kind of opposition to their vision within Western countries. And they think that, they think policies of mass migration are a path to that. They think that policies of essentially encouraging a certain sexual libertinism are a path to that. And so it seems that the culture war and the war in general is more or less a war to unseat these progressive leaders from power. I don't know if you consider that to be reasonable or what.
Well, I'm trying to work out how I can address what you've said without losing my channel or falling foul of hate speech laws. And, I'm afraid that you've kind of boxed me in here because I can't say anything without endangering myself. But let's just say, I think that a lot of the people who are doing this are not white. They call themselves white when it's convenient. But otherwise, they really do not conceive of themselves as white. But they do conceive of us as white. And you shouldn't be afraid of that term because it's being applied to you whether you like it or not.
I have a way.
I'm sorry. I just can't see. I think this is very, very stark. I know that it's complicated. I know that life is very, and the world is very complicated. And there are people, and the anti-cultural thing is true. It's real. But I think ultimately there is a racial war going on here. And the way you're framing this precludes you even recognizing that there is a war going on.
But what does it? I mean, help me out here, Woz, right? Like, I come from a multicultural community. I know that you could argue that, like, conservative multicultural communities are rare. They do exist. I think what the right needs right now is a vision of a vision that's not modernity, a vision of post-modernity that pushes back on this progressive vision of anti-culture that will destroy all cultures eventually, right? And it needs to provide a vision for all people. Now, within that vision, there's going to be space for people who want to live in multicultural enclaves. And I don't, there's nothing offensive about people who want to separate and form their own little ethnic enclaves outside of harassment. I don't see why that larger vision is offensive to people who want to live in an ethnic enclave or to want to have a nation that is focused around a particular culture or a particular group of people, a particular genetic descendancy. I don't see how those two visions are in conflict. As a matter of fact, I don't know if there's a possibility for individual cultural continuation without a larger vision to rule the world, to bring a lot of different people together and to get them all to live in peace.
Are you saying that we need to live together because otherwise there will not be peace? Like, we need to live alongside parallel societies and multicultural societies because otherwise there will not be peace?
No. Absolutely not. You don't need to live in a multicultural society. I think that, I mean, my ideal world would be a world of nations. Most nations, I think, should largely focus on their own people. It's the modern world. There'll be some amount of immigration, obviously. I don't think that immigration should be mass immigration. I don't think it should threaten the continuation of a nation's culture in the way that its ancestors had envisioned. I do think there needs to be a vision of how different peoples are going to live together in this world. For instance, Islam provides a vision of the world, right? It doesn't tell Turks and Persians that they have to live together, but it creates a system of rules, a way of understanding humanity's destiny that stands above each individual people's desire to carry on their culture and carry on their descendants' destiny into the future. And I think that's what's really necessary.
Well, do you think that the West used to have such a program and has now lost that? Or do you think it's never actually taken the time to develop such a conception of how we are going to coexist with the rest of the world, you know, colonized peoples and so on?
I hesitate to say that vision in some sense was the Christian vision. I can tell people are groaning in the chat right now, but it really was the idea when the sort of era of empires emerged was that at some point the world would be governed by a form of Christianity, but this would not mean that the Indian would move to London or that the Chinese would move to the Chinese person would move to Baghdad or vice versa. Every peoples would have their own pride and their own nation, but there would be a reigning understanding of what was true, a reigning cultural consensus that would help the world govern itself. And I think that reigning ethical system would have been, when we had originally started these empires, it would have been Christianity. In very much the same way that, in a very like loose sense, Christianity governed the late antiquity.
Somebody in the live chat, immediately before you mentioned Christianity, somebody said Distributus is hamstrung by his Catholic universalism.
That's a great point. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we are playing the game of universalism. The universalism, all successful ideologies are universalist. All claims that can conquer the world are universal because truth is universal. The most successful ideology, if we're going to exclude Western ones, which are currently being poisoned by this progressive confusion, the most successful ideology that's not Western is Islam. Islam is universalist. Every successful peoples, every successful tribe, every successful civilization, if you want to say every successful race, they've all had a universalist idea, a universalist concept going forward to build their empire. And even if they didn't make empires, they had a universalist philosophy to guide them in making their buildings and constructing their fleets of trade ships. I don't think you can get around universalism. And to retreat from universalism is to retreat from the large to the small. A retreat from universalism is a defensive posture. I don't think there's a way.
Well, I think you're conflating universalism as a program for how we're going to deal with the rest of the world. You're conflating that with we're all the same, really. right? But and we can all be brought into one culture.
But I don't maintain that we can be brought all into one culture. I don't think that the original claims, if we just go back to Christianity's claims in late antiquity, I don't think the mission of the Pope and the church then was to make Poland and France the same country. It was understood that the Poles and the French were their own people and would have their own interests. I don't want all countries to be merged together into one culture. I would prefer a patchwork of different cultures. I understand that, you know, there's been a certain amount of mixing up, and it's a global economy, and there will continue to be some mixing, right? And there needs to be spaces to accommodate that peacefully. But I'm not for corporate multiculturalism of George Soros. I think that maybe that's just a misunderstanding of what I've been advocating for.
Well, I think it sounds like you have a great degree of faith in culture as something that can pacify, unify, civilize, and direct people and reassure people.
Yes.
And be the source of their identity, the way they look at the world and so on. Whereas I, for example, might have a lot of faith in culture to do that, but also think that race is important as well to people's identity and probably how they view the world. And if nothing else, I mean, it's not like it has to be that way. I think it just is that way because people do care about their race, their racial identity and so on. Whether it's, I mean, other people have said this, centrists have said this, and lefties have said this, and people on identitarian right have said this as well. It's that race does seem to matter to people, even if rationally speaking, it doesn't need to. It just does. People do care about it. And so when you try to deny that and tell them you're just British, you're just Catholic, you're just Western, etc., they think, no, you're trying to hoodwink me into something here. I am a black man. I am whatever. I am a European. I am a white man. You know,
I don't want to downplay that existence. I'm not going to deny that existence either. I think that's a component of it. And I don't think the purpose of Christianity or Catholicism is to, like I said, I don't think the purpose is to make the African English or the English African. I think that I do agree that there are some forms of progressive Christianity, which I think has been highly perverted. They may consider that to be the true end of a religion is to essentially assist on the melting down of all distinctivenesses between peoples. But that's not my goal at all. My goal is, I really do want to see the thriving of all people and the thriving of all races, if we want to use that terminology.
I feel like we've only recently come to sort of this well-defined notion of race. But people before race was even really properly understood the pertinence of groups and solidarity inside your group, right? I mean, we didn't have to discover the other races to know about patriotism and to know about wanting to keep your homeland free from invaders, right?
Yeah, but once we did discover these other races, we realized, okay, these are more different from us than the French are. You know, these Australian Aborigines or whatever. There's a book, I think it's from the 19th, no, it must be the 18th century, where there's a sort of very racist, by today's standards, caricature of each of the races, including the European looking very stoical and all this, and then the African not looking so stoical, and the Chinese guy, and so they were aware, and these categories, I think it's five different categories, which I can't recall off the top of my head, but they are basically the same categories that we have now. So it's not something that only has been decided upon in the last 50 or 100 years. It's something that goes back more closer to like 500 years, really.
Oh, yeah, and people knew about race in ancient Greek times, right? Like you can see, I believe there's even Egyptian books that describe people can understand the difference between races. That's not, this is something like 2-year-old children can, right? This is not something that I think is controversial. I guess the point was on universalism is that it does seem at some point necessary that even if peoples are going to live separately, there still needs to be a governing ethics that can stand above them, that they all look towards. I think that's important.
Well, yeah, I see what you mean. Or they could just not interact. And I'm not even advocating. I'm just saying it's one possibility. Or they could do it on an ad hoc year to year, century to century basis, where there wasn't a need for an overarching thing all the time. It was just, okay, what are we going to do? Are you going to take these turnips off us, or are you going to rape our women, and etc.
I mean, you're going to have a lot of interaction in the global supply chain, aren't you? I mean, like, there's going to be a lot of interaction in the global supply chain.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I don't know that there is a need for an overarching a cultural superstructure, as it were, for the whole world. I'm not even against the idea. I'm just wondering if it's necessary, because I don't think we've ever actually had it before. Are you saying it's necessary now because of, globalization?
I mean, globalization has many meanings, one of which I'm entirely against, which I said before is this anti-human, anti-culture force that I really don't like. But globalization, in the sense that a lot of people from very, very far away are going to be trading with each other, I'm not against that, with some regulations, obviously. And I don't think that is going to go away. And when that doesn't go away, there are going to be corporations and combines that govern these trading relationships that are going to have a lot of power and a lot of communication. And there's going to be a cultural consensus that rules among those people. And I have a feeling that cultural consensus is going to rub off and become the cultural consensus of the ruling classes of the individual nations. And that this cultural consensus should have a way to justify the continuation of separate peoples and separate cultures on and on into the future indefinitely. And whereas that's what I'd like to see.
Whereas the elite that we have today are really constantly trying to promote the mixing of different of their own peoples into the great totality of the rest of the world. They don't seem to have. I mean, this is something that I think is very pronounced, and I think we sort of alluded to it earlier, that our elites seem to be hell bent on mixing us out of recognition.
I understand that we're like treading really closely to the dreaded third rail, but I agree that our current elites are really bad. But I think that to me, like, we have to start imagining what a good alternative elite would say and think. If you can reimagine a world of a lot of different peoples all trading together, what would the governing opinion of an international body look like? What would they, when they were setting their policies for the future of trading relationships, what would their vision of the future look like? What would they be working towards? And I think that's sort of like I'm thinking that the right needs a broader vision for that. I know this is vague in a lot of ways. It feels sort of like I'm hand-wringing.
I think what you're talking about is if we could reprogram the elite to be what we something better, something more conducive towards sanity and sustainability and all that. And how would we reprogram them to think? How would we have the elite think? And I would say that their notion should be that we're orchestrating the relationships, the working relationships between many different peoples. And the key thing is that the relationships should happen, but the peoples should remain separate.
Mm-hmm.
Right, or should at least remain distinct, if not even separate. They should remain distinct, and our conception of them should be as things that are going to remain distinct from each other. It is not our right to mix these things together. Whereas today, I think the elite feel that they do have that right, and even a moral duty perhaps, to mix everyone together so that there's no need for relationships anymore because there are no distinct things anymore.
Yeah, and they want, again, what the elite is dreaming of is global anti-culture, global non-culture, a globe, yes, of humans who exist only to consume. That's what they want.
And yes, and I agree with that. I do agree. And we can talk about the cultural thing and the anti-cultural thing. That's important. But when I talk about the elite wanting to mix peoples, I'm talking about at the genetic level as mm-hmm. well. Because I do agree with you that culture is a very important and sacred thing, and it's part of what makes us us, and it's daily life and all the rest of it. Yes, it's true. It's real and it's important. It's valuable. But also valuable is our genetic reality, because that is absolutely key part of what makes us us. And I think the elite want to mix everyone together because that's what they constantly talk about. I mean, it's not like this is some sort of wild conspiracy theory. They're constantly talking about, well, you know, 200 years from now, everyone's going to be brown. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they love it. So there's obviously some sort of currency in this for them. It obviously matters to them that they're going to eliminate racial differences. So race matters to them. And that's why I say perhaps it should matter to us as well, because if it matters to them, then there's a reason for that.
I'm not gonna lie and say I don't see what you're saying, Wells. You know, in 3 years ago, I would say if you were talking to me when I started my channel, I'd probably say you were crazy. But I'm not gonna say I can't see what you're saying. The only thing I have is a certain caution and taking individual instances where I can see what you're saying and then trying to draw them into a larger narrative that I feel might be jumping the gun, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes,
I do understand. A conspiracy, or, you know, I feel cautious about that, right? I will say this, just to talk about our elites a little bit. It is quite bizarre. You know, to change this topic slightly so we're not skating so close to the third rail, I just was reading articles, and we're talking about the global elite right now. You know, I have a bunch of blogs I used to read, and I was reading one from Reason Magazine, this person, Ronald Bailey, he was talking about the fact that there's a global fertility crisis, and people are talking about how the fertility crisis is going to impact the economy. And maybe I can pull this article up. And he says, he says this, I'm going to read this quote here. He says, so the report's written by a Stone on how the global Western fertility in Europe and America is sort of going to destroy our economy unless we boost our birth rates. He says, oddly, Stone mentions only in passing that immigration could sustainably ameliorate his economic concerns so long as fertility in other countries remains well above replacement. Then he goes on to say, basically, if technological progress can boost productivity sufficiently, rising wealth would still be able to pay social welfare bills as they come due. And this is the line I love. Who needs kids when you've got robots? So,
well, right. Okay.
And this is from a conservative magazine. This is from a conservative. I'm describing a generic. This is from Reason Magazine, a libertarian magazine, and you get this notion. Basically, it's treating human beings like economic
libertarian. Costs. You know, libertarians, though. I mean, you know, what if the robot consents, though? Right?
Yeah, exactly. So then here, going on here, and all I'm doing is to tell you how my view of the elites have changed. I went on today to open up another magazine that I used to read as a conservative about 3 or 4 years back, The Economist. And lo and behold, what did I find? But an extended interview of ContraPoints. ContraPoints, the YouTuber, right? The trans person, right? In which they're described as the new face of online populism. And after giving them a glowing interview, The Economist goes on to beg ContraPoints, is it, ContraPoints, do you think we have committed a moral malfeasance by interviewing Steve Bannon? And ContraPoints says something like, well,
My instinct is you probably have done something wrong by interviewing Steve Bannon, but there's also this to take into consideration, and they go on, right? And it's basically like a YouTuber is being brought on as the face of populism, and then people are asking why a political magazine that's supposed to be conservative is then asking them for moral permission to interview a high-level political functionary in a winning presidential campaign. And the third thing I saw today... Yeah, go ahead.
And that this conservative publication is asking permission from someone like ContraPoint.
Yes.
To interview a conservative Steve Bannon. This is just mad.
A moral authority, right?
Yeah.
So the third thing I saw today, I opened the paper, Trump has taken troops out of Syria, right? And I opened up another paper, and I can't remember where I read this, but I can link it. And I saw that no other than Noam Chomsky says that we have to stay in Syria. We have to keep our troops abroad to protect the Kurds. After 40 years of staunchly opposing every single military intervention, the second that Trump decides that he is going to draw down our involvement in the Middle East, the grandfather of progressive third worldism, the ultimate enemy of the American empire, discovers that he can learn to stop worrying and love endless foreign war.
Yeah, if Noam Chomsky's middle name happened to begin with P, then his initials would be NPC, wouldn't they?
Okay, that's quite clever. But what I wanted to say here is these three things, right? The libertarianism that wants robots rather than children, and that sees people as economic cogs that are totally replaceable. The conservative capitalist economic magazine that's looking to a supposedly anti-capitalist trans person for moral absolution, and then the third world of this communist who wants to support the American empire. I don't know if the left has principles yet. The only principle it has is that it wants to take any kind of particularism and destroy it and remove it. Why are The Economist and ContraPoint on the same side? ContraPoint says that they hate capitalism. The Economist is a pro-capitalist magazine. Why is Chomsky in favor of the American empire? Chomsky spent his entire career denouncing the American empire. Why is Ronald Bailey, supposedly the reasonable face of Reason Magazine, saying that we can replace our children with robots and that an African can replace a Swede and this will keep the economy humming along? The only thing that matters at the end of the day, like I said, is this push towards global anti-culture and this push towards dehumanization of the human individual. And that's the only connection I can see. The old political categories don't make any sense anymore. It seems like they've totally disintegrated in the last year.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know what... Yes, they have. And again, we're really... I think with this conversation, from multiple angles, we're coming up against the limits of free speech. And it's really frustrating, isn't it?
Well, I
it certainly is for me. I mean, maybe you're not quite so, desirous to speak of certain topics for them. I really feel we're just spinning our wheels if we can't talk about that topic. And,
I guess I see what's driving this as a, as just the machinations of incentives and capital. I don't know.
Hold on a second. Let me just reel back from that slightly.
Okay.
Because, you can push
back on that, right?
Just a wee bit, because it is important to remember that not all of the elite are of a certain type. That there are plenty of real white people in the elite. I always think of Hillary Clinton or Tony Blair, indeed, who are completely committed. And then look at these dreadful politicians in the EU, like that guy Verhofstadt, people like him. I think Franz Timmermans, completely just awful, complete weaklings who would destroy everything. And they are native Europeans. So it is something. It's not just cucking out. It is a fact that this, we do have to admit that this is not entirely an attack on us by an outside force. It is also something in us that is causing, maybe you could say that Hillary Clinton is simply a psychopath. She's simply power mad, and she doesn't really care about one thing or the other. She just cares about her own advancement, and maybe Tony Blair's the same. And they don't actually have an ideological goal or any goal, except that they want power. They want personal power. In which case, this objection or this caveat becomes kind of meaningless. I don't know.
I mean, to get us away again, I guess we just keep on stepping towards the third rail, and we really should. I mean, how I kind of wanted to segue this is, well, what can the right do to stop it? So I, for one, think that we need a broader universalist vision of what the destiny of humanity will be, that is pro-cultural, that is pro-human, that is pro-posterity, that is pro-particularisms between different cultures and different peoples, that supports everyone's ability to carry on their culture the way they see fit and to group together as they see fit. I think that vision is very, very important for the right. I will say the other thing I kind of want to talk about is what to do. How are we going to organize right now? And I guess sort of what I am kind of seeing as a problem for the right now is we seem to have a hard time imagining how we're going to push back other than like civil war or something like that.
Yeah. you're right. And the free speech thing, of course, is also crucial. I mean, I think this conversation has demonstrated that we end up sort of faffing around like kids rather than like adults, yeah. You know. This is very irritating and kind of humiliating, actually.
I don't want to. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I know, and I don't. I mean, I don't go on about it either. But I don't want to be simplistic. And it's easy to just pin everything on one thing. And you know, I know. But this particular thing is important. So it's annoying that we can't talk about it. But to get back to what you just said about the right.
Yeah, I've heard yes. A lot of people. On the channel say like, oh, well, and one person in particular said this, and I don't want to mention them by name because I'm probably going to be interviewing them, but they said something like, well, the white pill is that there's going to be a physical civil war and we are definitely going to win against the establishment. I think very definitively that winning a civil war would be incredibly difficult to win against a force that has much more money. It would involve being highly, highly organized and having a command structure everywhere throughout all sympathetic right-wing groups. And in the meantime, if it never gets organized, having a bunch of random people who own guns, like on a hair trigger, ready to go for a civil war, is a recipe for making sure that any political advancement will be utterly futile in other spheres. In the meantime, it will literally self-justify the use of physical force against the right wing on the part of the progressive establishment, and it will reunify a progressive coalition that would otherwise be at each other's throats. So I don't see this as a successful or winning strategy going forward. That's not to say that you shouldn't own a gun. That's not to say that you shouldn't know how to safely use one and safely defend yourself. My family is a gun-owning family in Canada, no less. This is not something that you shouldn't know how to do. Legally, I should say, too. This is not something that you shouldn't know how to do. But at the same time, I think that the political plan that's needed to go forward is one of organization peacefully, and one that focuses on getting very, very competent leaders that can speak and connect with communities that may have differences to each other. There are many
different communities in the anti-progressive coalition inside the dissident right. We have very big disagreements that have manifested on this very talk right now. We have differences in what we think is important to preserve. The thing that unifies us is that we understand that the progressive establishment, the progressive global capital that rules us, is eventually going to destroy what we're trying to preserve in the long run. And I think what we need right now to do that is we need competent leaders and leaders that can organize locally and online. And we need to keep ourselves calm, even as things get crazy around us. And I think that's very, very important. What I really am afraid of is that a bunch of people are going to get spooked as the progressive establishment starts taking steps forward, that they start shooting at people. And then the progressive establishment uses this as a way to patch itself up and justify the use of even more punitive force against conservative and reactionary communities in the West. And that's what I'm very concerned about. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people will have pushback against that, but I think that's where we need to be thinking right now.
Yes, I agree. I think there needs to be, if not coordination, there needs to be a link up between many different people. I mean, you know, we are kind of doing that just now on YouTube, or we're trying. You and I are trying to do that for reasons, and that's a sort of microcosm of what we're talking about here. We need to be on speaking terms with each other. All sorts of people who have disagreements and even vendettas against each other need to be able to communicate, because otherwise there's just total lack of cohesion, total breakdown of function, and diminishment of potency on the battlefield. And that, of course, just leaves us totally vulnerable to being defeated, to being crushed by our mutual enemies. And now, you know, so I think that, yes, coordination or link up is just necessary right now in a huge way.
The thing that we need to see the immediate fall of is white progressivism. The kind of progressivism embodied by Chapo Trap House, the podcast, the kind of progressivism embodied by the late night shows, this kind of comfortable white progressivism, this, first of all, that is on the way to being destroyed, but it is something that needs to be called out and weakened whenever we can. And I think it quite strangely enough, it's given us the possibility to defeat it. Why is the white progressive even prominent in their own movements? By their own logic, they shouldn't be. And once progressivism becomes...
What do you mean? Could you explain that, what you just said?
Okay, so the progressive movement is something that constantly talks about the need for minority voices, for non-white voices in it. The reason why they have their prominent white faces in the progressive movement right now is that they need to present themselves as non-threatening.
Oh, I see. Sorry, I didn't realize you'd said white. Yes, okay, I get it. I totally understand it. Yes.
So, like, at the end of the day,
in theory, if everyone's equal, then that guy in charge of BLM, who's really obviously white, he shouldn't need to be there. It should be a real black guy who's in charge of BLM.
Or why is Chapo Trap House the most prominent podcast on the left? It's like five white guys, like, talking about their white opinions, right? Like, well, people on the progressive movement see this, right? And what really needs to be... what really needs to be destroyed is any comfortable place there is for people of European descent on the left. And in the meantime, on the right, these concerns, the concerns of the left, and many of the concerns on the left are very legitimate, need to be incorporated and heard, as long as they're not destructive to the goals of giving, of essentially, of preservation and well-being of people's posterity.
I completely agree. And, you know, this is something that's been on my mind for the last couple of months, maybe longer than that, 3 months now, maybe, that the right needs to expand. It needs to, especially the alt-right. I think the alt-right got just too shrill, and I don't use this word lightly, too intolerant. When it didn't have the right to be, it didn't have the power to be. It didn't, you know, it was not in a position to be that prescriptive and narrow-minded. And but you know, I don't want to go into the alt-right because that's just a fucking can of worms. But the point is that I do think that the right in general could benefit from more interaction within itself, and also interaction with the outside, especially the well, the centrists for sure, and also the let's see what if there's anything that we can agree with the progressives on, because the progressives, yeah, as distinct from the globalists, because globalism is a different thing, and it might well be that we end up isolating globalism as the true enemy here.
That's the critical thing.
Yeah. Because and I don't see myself ever being pro-globalism. I think that, and again, there was something I saw, I think it was yesterday or the day before, I saw somebody drawing a distinction between globalism and globalization. I think it was in a Black Pigeon Speaks video, actually. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But someone said, we don't necessarily need to do away with all the benefits of globalization in order to defeat globalism as an ideology. Now, those are actually two different things. So globalism, I think, is the true enemy. And it might be that the left, both the old left and the, you know, what we often think of as crazy modern, you know, the new left, the progressives, and maybe they are not as alien from us as we think. And maybe they could be surprised to find that we are not as alien from them as they have come to think.
I think that our enemies have miscalculated. I think they've critically miscalculated at this juncture, and that they've opened up a possibility in this regard. And I'm not trying to re-up this, but it's very relevant. But Sargon's removal from Patreon has re-triggered a question on a much broader scale. The right needs to rebrand itself as the place where interesting conversations can happen that break from the very, very, very narrow script that progressives have laid out as being things that you can possibly talk about without being deplatformed or fired. That's what the right needs to rebrand itself as.
Well, it's not even things that you can possibly talk about. It's statements that you can possibly make about those things. You've got to have the right opinion on everything.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're in danger. It's literally at that point now. I mean, it's like there's a gun against your head. Obviously not a gun. I don't want to be too dramatic. But there's a threat. If you say something we disagree with, you are going to be fucked. You're literally going to lose your livelihood. That's unbelievable. That situation, yeah, but it is real at this point. It's come, it's arrived. They are now that shrill.
Yeah, I think that this creates a huge opportunity, because of the fact that if they're going to start deplatforming people like Sargon and perhaps even people like Jordan Peterson, I'm sure that's coming soon, then the right is the only place where actually interesting conversations happen. And if we can use this opportunity to build alternative technology and make something like a distant technology alliance, a group of websites that we know from, that we either have as open source, or that we know the CEOs, we know the owners, and we know that they're committed to free speech. If we can produce that and facilitate a new conversation in those communities, and also develop new ethical guidelines so that we can have conversations that are safe and interesting and inviting, this will be a huge threat to the progressive establishment, because the progressive idea space is so stale. This is the third time. You maybe don't know these people, the Chapo guys, right? But I was listening.
I've seen some clips of them, and I just thought it was so awful. It was such a pathetic attempt to do blatantly to ape the rightstuff.biz. And it just cannot work. It just can't work, because the left are in charge. They're in control. They dominate the culture. And so you can't pretend to be some sort of angry firebrand leftist who's dangerous for the establishment when you're just going to uphold all of the establishment's ideas anyway. It's pathetic. Well,
I understand that whenever you view someone else's political comedy, it never comes off as funny because you don't agree with them. But at the same time, I'm listening to Chapo, and it feels like, this is what it feels like. It feels like if you took Jon Stewart's political opinions circa 2008, and they haven't updated, they're still complaining about the Iraq war, even though the current problem is Syria. They hardly even mention Syria. It's always the Iraq war, right from 2006. You took that, you combined it with like the Dave Barry style colonist humor from the 90s. And then on top of that, you played a Cards Against Humanity game where each time you made a joke, you flipped over and inserted another like super dirty image just to get the edginess in, right? It feels incredibly stale. The entire thing, I'm not surprised anyone buys it, and people do buy it. But I have to believe that this is at some point going to come back, that people are going to realize that this is stale.
Stale and completely, tragically, disgustingly impotent.
I wonder, and I think people, there's one difference between TRS and El Chapo, well, it's not El Chapo, it's Chapo Trap House, and that is Chapo never has contravailing opinions on their podcast. It doesn't work. And so I think that eventually, if the new right, whatever we want to call it, can develop...
I like the dissident right. I like that name, dissident right.
I that's going to work for a little bit, right?
Reminds me of Blake 7. It sounds kind of dark and interesting and fun. Go on.
Essentially, we're going to have to rebrand whatever the right coalition is, because the right coalition will always be associated with its worst advocates. It doesn't matter if you're an anti-racialist like myself, you're always going to be associated with the worst elements of the right. But just back on, if the right is successful at getting a few public personalities that are very, very hard to impeach at some kind, on some kind of legitimate concern, if they appear to be honest, if they appear to be intelligent and polite, if a leftist sees this person in the public square and realizes that it's not just Tucker Carlson, it's not just, well, certainly not just Steve Bannon, but it's not just any number, it's not just Roger Scruton, it's not just any number of right-wing personalities, that there's a whole class of intelligent people that they have to sit down and eat dinner with, perhaps at Thanksgiving, and that none of the Chapo Trap House jokes from 2008 ever seemed to refer to this class of people, they're going to start to understand that their media intake is incredibly stale. That the jokes that ContraPoints and that every comedian on the left tells about the dissident right and the non-mainstream right are just not representative of reality. And I think that quest begins and ends with good leadership and with people that are responsible both at the local level and online.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I agree. I think there are people need to step up to the plate. And is that the right expression? Have I got that right?
Yep.
That needs to happen. I think people need to get a lot more real about what the stakes are, what the situation is, and how vulnerable we all are. And stop faffing around. I mean, there's so much, and I've gone on for ages about the infighting and all that kind of rubbish. I just wish I could get through to people what we're up against. That's part of it. And I also think
Do not underestimate the progressive establishment's power. Do not underestimate the progressive establishment's power. Like that is a key rule of fighting this battle. They are very, very wealthy and very, very well situated.
Yeah.
I want to blackmail people, but that's it. That's the thing.
But, It's not a black pill. It's just, it's reality. It's a truth that people need to hear so that they can deal with it and work with the truth, not a delusion. And there are multiple, I'm not going to go into it, but I think there are lots of people who are just approaching this in ways that are not going to work. So we need to get real. And so I think that is the situation that we're at now. I think that this year was largely, and last year, was a sort of no man's land. And I think that now we are starting to see the beginnings of something new and broader and more open-minded than the alt-right. And also more interactions between us and the centrists and so on. I think there's far more interaction going on now. Maybe I'm sort of biased because I'm at the center of millennial, which, you know, whatever. But I think that other people would agree that there seems to be far more interaction now between the various factions than there was a year ago or even 6 months ago. And that, I think, is a result of our mutual demonization by our mutual enemies pushing us together. And whether that's tactically advantageous for our enemies to do so, or whether it's an unfortunate side effect of their behavior, I don't know. But either way, it is happening.
And we have to always remember that they're in power and we're not. And our goal is to essentially to win a right in a space from them to safely profess our beliefs and to practice our lifestyles.
Yes. Yes. The chat just said, press one for new beginnings, and lots of people are pressing one. I think this is it. You know, either because we have been feeling stagnant and listless and kind of depressed for the last year or two, for obvious reasons that I don't need to go into. And I think that now that there is this feeling of the engine is switching on again. It's starting to warm up. There's something's happening. We don't know what it is yet, but it's there is new life coming, and you know, it's exciting. And you know, this is partly what I was. I mean, I don't know how, if you saw my Acedia and Crisis series.
Oh, I love that. I love that. That was
right. Okay,
that was exactly right. The kind of content that I really like of yours. Maybe this is the Catholic in me, but I love a good confessional. I kind of fell in love with your content's confessional nature, you know, the early confessional nature of your channel.
Well, I mean, there were many things that fed into that series and why I did it, but one of them was there needs to be a new beginning. There needs to be a new start. And we need to sort of flush out all of this rubbish. So that, and these, you know, delusions and defeatism and wrong, silly ways of thinking, so that we can start again. And which I also saw characterized in my desire to do abstract art, which is kind of dissipated now. But I thought there's some reason I'm being drawn back into the abstract and the therapeutic, the emotional and the spiritual. There's some reason that I was really driven to do that. And as it happened, I never got a chance to because, you know, the life happens very fast. Like October was nonstop for me. So I never got a chance to do that kind of thing. Maybe I'll do it in January, but again, there's so much to do in January and February that I don't think I'll get a chance then either. The point is, there was some reason why I detached from the channel and everything. And I think that reason has now expanded to the movement as a whole. The whole, everyone seems to desire this new start.
No, I think that the desire for art is incredible. I think that's what everyone should be trying to go for. We should all be making art. I've tried to encourage others in my community to make art. We also need to secure a platform for that expression so that the artists among us can be heard and promoted, so that we can show the art that we've created and hold it up against the rivals in the mainstream, and for people to recognize that as something that can't so easily be dismissed as horrible people.
And I think that's why I think the quest of 2019 is going to be to secure that platform. You know, I can't believe we haven't taken more steps to do this. I was going to talk to Sargon a little bit about this, but I can't believe we haven't taken more steps to secure platforms for ourselves. But this is going to be the struggle going forward. And I don't know, maybe that's a good stopping point. Or we could talk about the other options.
Well, I don't have... Yeah. Well, my next guest isn't due for another 40 minutes, so you know, there's no rush here.
There was one more thing that's a little bit more lighthearted that we could trade.
Oh, come on, not lighthearted. Come on. Not after this.
We have a third rail of YouTube that we can't touch. You know, we both disagree about how important that third rail is, but we know we can't touch it. I don't think it's as important as you, but since we can't touch it, we can't talk about it. But there's another group that is highly vilified on the dissident right that I can talk about, the boomers. because this is another obstacle that really is a problem for the right. And that is that the people who have the funding money, the people who control the purse strings on the right, and even the people who control the purse strings in the middle, among the moderates, they're all of the boomer generation and of the Xer generations.
And so what you're saying is that, like that other group, that the boomers could be our greatest allies.
The boomers could be our greatest allies, but they don't see the problem. Right? But come on, Bruce, Boomertopia is our greatest ally.
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt with a silly joke.
Steven Pinker just finished writing a book about why this is such a tiresome title. It's such a tiresome title, and Steven Pinker being a boomer, tell me if you've heard this before. My case for radical centrism, why we need to put aside the craziness of both the left and the right and embrace common sense. I mean, that book must have been written before, right? Like, every boomer has written this book. Every boomer has read this book. It never goes anywhere. But Steven Pinker, boomer as he is written it again. And boy, is this time, is he going to get the message through? This is a huge problem, and it's more of a problem for the right than it is for the left, because I think that the people who have the money on the left understand that this process of trying to take things back to the 90s isn't going to work anymore. Unfortunately, on the right, the boomer who doesn't understand the problem we're dealing with is a serious, serious problem. And I think that if we're going to list another goal for 2019, that isn't securing a platform through alternative technology and through real life organization, the other big goal in 2019 is to come towards some kind of messaging that can capture the imagination of the boomers. I know this is a hard one, but we've got to start thinking in this way, because if you don't, there's not going to be any funding. And funding is the lifeblood for any activist community. I did an analysis before this whole Patreon debacle happened. I went to about 15 of the prominent YouTube channels on the right and the left. No alt-righters, because I know that they're banned from Patreon before the Sargon thing. And it turns out that if you're a YouTuber on the left, you make you make 4 to 5 to, in some cases, 6 times the amount of dollars per view that your equivalent on the right does. So that means that the left pays its activists way, way more than the right does. And I think that manifests in actual results. And that's on YouTube, a platform that supposedly is dominated by the right.
I've got some olives here, so I've got to speak with an olive in my mouth. I do apologize.
No problem.
I didn't know you were about to stop speaking.
Oh, so. I can continue. Anyway,
let's isolate what you mean when you say that the left gets paid more per view. Are you talking about that? Because it's very difficult to quantify, but you explain more.
So if I have a YouTube channel that gets, I don't know, that gets 1,000 views a day, right? Then I can expect to get paid 4 times as much if it's a leftist YouTube channel that gets 1,000 views a day than I can if it's a right-wing YouTube channel that gets that 1,000 views a day.
This is because of their Patreon or because of YouTube ad revenue, right? Okay.
This is because of Patreon. And also, if you're a left-wing YouTuber, your videos are less likely to be demonetized, which is another big thing. So it is much easier to go into YouTube and become an activist that can live off of their YouTube than it is to be on the right. And that's not even taking into consideration that being on the right in YouTube means that you have a whole history of saying things online that could be used against you in a professional environment otherwise. Right. So,
yeah, it's a tougher life for sure.
Yeah. And I think what we need to start working on is creating a culture that supports activism. And I guess this is linked to the boomers because, like I said, the boomers are holding the purse strings. In 2019, we need to find a way to communicate with them, to appeal to them, to put the problems we're dealing with in some way that they can swallow. I think Tucker Carlson has got a good handle on how to do this. I know a lot of older people who listen to him. He's changing a lot of minds about what's needed. Someone like Dr. Steve Turley would also be a place to look. I think we're on the opposite side of the white and black pill, him and I, but he's a person who makes good content. And it appeals to a much older crowd and a much more, a much more normie crowd than anything I've ever made. But this is the kind of dialogue that I think the right has to master in order to really take the next step in 2019.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't really thought of, but I think you're right. The way I'd seen this was that I think that funding will come from wealthy individuals probably more than from, you know, organizations. But either way, I think that it's going to go towards probably organizations on the right, not individuals. And so those organizations, well, and the individuals on the right, have to seem worthy of financial support. And right now, there's a lot of shambolic individuals or more organizations than individuals. Shambolic organizations on the right that frankly don't deserve financial support because they're not going to get anywhere. So they need to shape up, and then they will get financial support.
Reactionaries have this expression, like, become worthy of ruling and then rule.
Yes.
Sometimes I kind of shirk at this because of the fact that a lot of times when you're dealing with conservatives in particular, like, you get these kind of platitudinous recommendations like work harder or like fight harder. It doesn't really mean anything. Right. Like a general, there are great generals in history, but no great general in history was a great general because he told his men to fight harder. Recommendations come in nuanced form. But I think there is something to the reactionary platitude of becoming worthy to rule. And that is that you have to present a face and also be able to be the kind of person that can be counted on to do the things that he promises. So I have to be the kind of person where a funder could give me a certain amount of money and I could deliver on that, that I can create a space that's safe for people to operate who have careers and who aren't just trolls on the internet, right? Who don't care about their career. And this is a transition that the dissident right is just going to have to make, if not in 2019, hopefully in later years. But until it does that, and becomes and sort of takes a step towards adulthood, it's going to have a very hard time attracting that kind of funding.
Yeah. What you're saying is that you're talking about professionalizing.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not simplifying it. I know that this is complex. It's a complex matter, but in a word, it is professionalizing. It's growing. Well, growing up is another way to phrase it. I mean, it's a dilemma for me because, we don't need to go into it, but I'm just wondering how much we will have to change in order to be, you know, deserving of more support.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you don't want to lose the core of what distinguishes you from national review, right? But you do want to be a person that is responsible, that can take. I mean, I like this phrase. It comes from corporate America, and it also comes from the military. Taking ownership over something, meaning that, like, I take ownership over this channel. I take ownership over this online community, which means that if something goes wrong with it, like, I step in and take responsibility and make sure that this is rectified in the best possible way. And to the extent that it's not rectified, this is my fault. And I'm the person, the buck essentially ends with me. I don't, when something goes wrong, I just don't go hands off. Oh, it's not my problem. Blame somebody else. Right. And I think if we exhibit this kind of ownership over what little we have currently, we can use it as a basis to grow and to possibly make a movement that has larger ambitions and that can support larger ambitions and support broader funding.
Well, I mean, every day I see more, I see something new, I encounter something new that cannot be done or cannot be done properly because there isn't the infrastructure to do it. And there isn't the infrastructure because there isn't the funding. You know, if we had funding, we would grow rapidly, I think, as a movement, very rapidly. I mean, it's no surprise. This is why the left are so paranoid about us. They're so hysterical because they know there is. I mean, it's not that we are in a great condition and we're just all, you know, ready to go. We're not. But our ideas are very tempting and interesting to people. And I would even say they are timely and, you know, necessary for society. And I think the left know that. So, you know, this is why they're trying to deplatform us all the time.
I always think of a community that I was a member of in the 90s, the open source community. It was all of these programmers that were just dedicating their time to the project of open source. It didn't seem like a model that couldn't be followed by people on the right in the wake of this Patreon fiasco. It seems like something that we should try to follow.
Sorry, I had to deal with that message there. Could you repeat what you just said?
I said when I was in the 90s, I was a member of the open source community, and that was a community of software developers that just dedicated their time to make free and open software, and it worked really well. The movement has been totally inundated with the people we would call social justice warriors now. But it showed to me that you can run responsible organizations that don't have very much funding. It is possible. So,
well, I think
they have hope.
Yes, but surely the reason that the thing there is that there was always a goal, a clearly defined goal in an open source community. It would be the project that we're working on now. It needs to be functional. It needs to look good. It needs to be easy to use. It needs to be modular. It needs to be flexible, and so on. I mean, once everyone's got a goal and everyone knows what it is, and everyone respects that goal and enjoys it, then they work towards it. This is a fucking crucial part of male psychology that I don't think we, maybe we've come to forget it in some sense. You know, if you give men something to do, they will lap up that challenge, that opportunity to make something of themselves by working on this project together.
And if there's a project, if there's one project like that we need right now, it's an alt-tech alliance to keep the focus on developing new platforms that are open to conversations that are not progressive approved and that can review existing platforms for their viability and future-proofing. This is something that I fully expect to see this in the next year. And I think that its development is just going to be essential. And I think that this whole Sargon fiasco is going to be the impetus for its development. And it will involve people from all varieties of non-progressive thought. It will involve a very, very large umbrella, but we just need this now.
I agree. I mean, I think it might be interesting to end on, I mean, we've got 20 minutes left. Why don't we talk about, or you talk about what you see as the ramifications of what has happened recently with Sargon, because and it has been talked about in previous millennials this year, this whole censorship thing. I mean, we don't need to go into it again unless you want to, but I think everyone knows the situation. So I think it'd be moving forwards, it would be to talk about what you think are going to be the repercussions of what's happened recently. Because, I did actually talk to Sargon last night, and he said that he thinks it's shaping, or he said it could be shaping up to be another Gamergate.
Well, I'll put it this way. There's been much debate. You know, if you imagine the censorship that's going on the internet, like an encroaching blob coming forward, consuming everything, Sargon presents an interesting inflection point. There's been a lot of debate over whether Sargon is a gate or whether he's a bridge. But whether he's a gate or a bridge, that gate or bridge just got swallowed by the censorship blob. And I think that he's sort of a critical test case because the fact that he's so entirely ordinary. And I do think that this is something, I think Gamergate's a bad example because I think this needs to be bigger than Gamergate. I think Gamergate had a juvenile dimension to it that always prevented it from becoming that anything more important than what it ultimately was. Other than that, I think that this kicks off the possibility for a new approach to things. It's obvious that Patreon is just going to be an echo chamber for progressive opinion and for people who don't care about financing their non-political projects in a space.
Let's just say one thing. I think that at this point, Patreon can't back down now. They could have backed down a week ago, 10 days ago, but not now, because it's all just become so, it would be such a massive, embarrassing climb down and humiliating for them. And it would seem to violate so much of their ideological framework at this point, because they've staked so much of their ideological framework on that this was the right thing to do. So they now cannot back down. So they're locked into this. And so it's a permanent condition now that has been established. So go on.
Yeah, I think that they can't back down. And if you've listened to Matt Crissendom from Beauty and the Beta, he does a podcast with Blonde in the Belly of the Beast. He recently had a conversation with a person from the Trust and Safety Council from Patreon. And it is the most hilarious dialogue I've ever heard. Sargon and V did a little pantomime that they released like 5 minutes before I stepped on here. That is utterly hilarious, with V doing kind of a womanly falsetto that it feels like it comes straight out of like 19th century vaudeville, frankly. but it's just the simpering, like mewling nature of the corporate representative as they sort of like try to explain that after everything, Patreon's just going to ban whoever they feel like banning. And all they're there to do is to explain away the feelings of the people making these decisions. This is totally unworkable with any business model to speak of.
But, and remember the bit where she said that if somebody was a content creator who's on Patreon, if he's in doubt about whether something he wants to do will violate the rules, he should contact Patreon and ask. So this is course, like the Politburo in a Soviet state or something.
And of course, no rules are issued ahead of time, right? You can't engage in a set of rules. You have to essentially go to the commissar in charge of the opinion police and see how that officer is feeling at any given time. that this is insane. Everyone can see this is insane. And this conversation needs to be published. So
we're now going to be at the mercy of these people who, I mean, it's ridiculous because, as you say, it does relies on the mood that they're in that day, what kind of day they've had, what articles on, Vice that they've just read,
what BuzzFeed articles are popular. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally emotional, and everyone can see this. I can't have the paycheck I draw be dependent on the person on this leader's emotion in any given day, or you know what Samantha Bee said last night. Right, this is not workable, and everyone knows it's not workable. I think that this avenue needs to be exposed, and Patreon has to suffer from this, and it will suffer from this. And this needs to be followed up with direct legal action. People have been talking about the fact that what PayPal did specifically in light of this, essentially cracking down on the competitors of Patreon, when there are known links, when there are known executives that share ties between PayPal and Patreon, this could run afoul of the United States antitrust law. If the FCC was to begin an investigation, that might end Patreon. It would cost Patreon so many legal fees that it could seriously threaten their business model.
What a ridiculous situation that they've. I mean, what a ridiculous situation they've ignited. They've created out of. They didn't need to do this. None of this needed to happen, but they did this thing. I mean, it's bad enough that they censored the alt-right. It's bad enough that they censored all these other people before this. But now they've done this, and it brings it to a much wider audience, and it brings higher profile, and they have to respond to various people accosting them for it. And the responses they give expose their hypocrisy,
their lack of
understanding, yeah, their lack of integrity.
It's a gift. Yeah. I mean, I think that this is a huge opportunity, and I have to go. I might have to draw this to a close now. I was only planning on talking for an hour and a half. But this combined with what obviously YouTube has planned, YouTube really wants to unseat people like PewDiePie, who have shown, I think very implicitly, some right-wing sympathies. It's going to have a very, very hard time doing this, but it appears that there are forces inside these corporations that care more about having this ideological catharsis than they have in making their models of power sustainable. And this is a gift that the right needs to exploit and exploit really hard.
I thought you were going to say that they care more about ideology than they care about profit, but actually you just said that they care more about ideology than about their long-term power.
Well, saying they care more about ideology than profit is saying they care more about ideology than power. I hate to borrow a Christopher Hitchens expression, but this is how long the termites have dined on these organizations, is they've essentially they've progressivized themselves into imbecility. And this is the real part of the progressive left that we can exploit to move forward.
All right. Well, that's very interesting. I think that there is a huge amount to be said about all of this. I wonder if we'll be allowed to say it on YouTube or if we'll all get deplatformed. Obviously, we're only scratching the surface. This is only the beginning of a real renaissance, I feel. Would you say that's true?
I say that's absolutely true. There's a lot of interesting ideas on the right now. If you go to reaction, and if you go to neo-reaction, and if you go to just Catholic thinking generally, it's going to get broader, right? The progressive establishment, its view has become so narrow that they have to essentially exclude more and more types of thinking from their circle. And this opens up the realm of the anti-progressive to basically being the inheritors of all sorts of thinkers. It's so strange that on the right, you're going to find people who are more well-versed, not only in Thomas Aquinas, not only in Joseph de Maistre, but also in Friedrich Nietzsche. Because with the exception of a few, and a very, very few subset of German philosophers, and 20th century existentialists, all other philosophical thinking is essentially shut down for the left. And that means that we could be in the middle of a renaissance in right-wing thinking. I think we are seeing it right now.
Yeah, I agree. The left has become brittle. Someone just said in the live chat, the left has been lying for so long that they now believe the lies, and that makes them extremely vulnerable. Because if you're a trickster, you have to know that you're tricking in order to stay on top of the game. I think the left are now in a position where they've forgotten that they've been lying all along, you know, about the human condition, about men and women, about various, many things that we could name. And so they're now very vulnerable, because, and this is why they can't debate their own points anymore. They because that requires self-awareness, self-examination, and they're allergic to it, because they know that it all comes tumbling down as soon as they do examine their beliefs to whatever extent they're even capable of doing so.
They can't examine. They can only congratulate. They can only self-congratulate. That's why ContraPoints has been celebrated more than she's ever talked to people on the right. Or
that's a good example of something that I was going to say earlier, is that when ContraPoints debated Sargon of Akkad, she was completely annihilated. And it's so telling, because she has made a point of saying that you shouldn't debate the alt-right. Don't give them the attention that they want, that they so desperately crave from us and all this. But the real reason is that when she debates the alt-right, it's total defeat for her. Just like the rest of the left that we're talking about, they cannot defend their own ideas.
When they debated me, that channel was utterly destroyed on their points too. They had no capacity to defend their position. But every time they get, and ever since then, they've been celebrated in the New York Times and The Economist, on Slate, constantly celebrated, and every time pushing back, taking the conversation to the right. They don't have the conversation, because the conversation can't occur. And maybe we can leave it there, but where the conversation exists, there will be the renaissance. And I think that's why the right is going to be the place of that pro-cultural renaissance.
Yes, I agree. And spiritual renaissance as well.
Absolutely.
Because the left has become anti-culture and anti-white, but it's also become anti-health in every sense of that word, I think.
It's become anti-human. It's become anti all cultures. It's not, we went over the whole what it's anti to begin with. But before we open up yet another box that we can't close, I did check that Star Trek Next Generation quote, and you're right, Q does say the Borg is the ultimate user.
Bloody hell, I haven't seen it since 2010. I'm amazed that I got that right. Well, there we are. It's not that I have a photographic memory. It's just that particular quote, I remember it jumped out at me, and I thought, that's a really interesting concept. So there we are.
Well, at any rate, I have to go now, Woz, but thank you so much for having me on.
It's been a really interesting conversation. I hope that other people have enjoyed it. Have you enjoyed it in the live chat? Say one if you've enjoyed it, because lots of people ask for the distributist. So I hope that this is... has sated you, at least for now.
Well, I think there's there's a lot of avenues we opened up on this conversation. Like there's a lot of disagreements. It's funny what we agree on and what we don't agree on. Like my anti-racialism is something that I know I take a lot of heat for, and I can defend it, right? But it's also funny what we agree on, right? I think we could have a lot of more conversations, both on what we agree on and what we disagree on. And I think it's just up to people to tell me and you what they want to hear in the future.
Well, one thing that we certainly agree on is that whatever our differences, we want to smash the globalists, right?
Yeah. we need to shut down the people who are essentially bringing drag queen story time to every library in America. Yes, please.
Yes, definitely.
What number do I press for end drag queen story time in American libraries? Is it one?
Well, speaking of which, there have been many ones when I asked lots of people. So yes, I think lots of people have enjoyed this conversation. So it's been a long time coming, as you said, and it happened to come not at a time of relative calm and simplicity, but right in the middle of a huge, confusing time. But that's the way it's happened. And anyway, I'm sure that there will be many more conversations between us in the future. So,
Absolutely. Great.
All right. Well, this has been a good one. And so, Dave the Distributist, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2018.
Thanks. Have a blessed holidays.
Thank you very much. You too. And I will be back in about 10 or 15 minutes with, I believe it's Cultured Thug. Let me just check. Yes, it is. Cultured Thug. So I will see you then. Hope you enjoyed this. Bye for now.